diary, and I noticed in there that there was a couple times that Maxime Le Pen kind of wanted to break away from Riel for that reason, that they didn't, that Louis Riel didn't accept the priest.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that that Louis Riel...
We turn right here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do believe that Louis Riel was a bit right. You know, I have in my mind a bit that Louis Riel was a bit at times maybe depressed or overloaded or something.
Uh-huh.
And for that reason, some people were saying that he was insane and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You, I'm not learning you anything there, am I?
No, you can read that. A lot of people said he was...
So, but as far as the... Like I was telling you about Maxime Le Pen, he was a fervent, fervent Catholic. He was a good believer. So the priest would be inclined to maybe control a man like Maxime Le Pen.
Are we?
If the priest would say, well, Maxime, Louis Riel is wrong, and, you know, he shouldn't be doing this and that and that, he'd be inclined to maybe shy away a little bit, although he was still... I know those Le Pens there. Well, I know my wife's brothers. They're all determined fellas. They're fighters. They were, you know, they'd fight in a... They were kind of tough guys a bit, and the old men Le Pen there seemed to be of that nature a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is where a little bit of friction would come in between Louis Riel and some of these older fellas.
Yeah.
But although they had great faith in Louis Riel too, though.
Yeah.
You know, at times they thought that he was the real man, because Louis Riel was always trying to get into something without having to cause trouble and bloodshed and things like that. So there was a little bit of a balance there, and I think that's why that his renown was good, is because he was always trying to be good and do good to people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But old Gabriel, if I know, and I know his family, I know guys like that fellow we've seen today, I know his dad, Ernest Jamon, them fellas, they were fellas kind of tough, you know, and they figured that they'd stand their ground, you know, amongst people. And I do believe that old Gabriel Jamon was that type of a man.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason, while he wasn't scared of the soldiers or anything, he'd have fought his way if he could. So there was a little bit of a difference in the ways of those two men. They weren't the same type of men, I don't think. And I think that's why the older people and the old ladies would think more of Louis Riel.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's too bad that that the government wouldn't take notice of their demands, because all they'd had to do, but then the people would say, well, why give them land? But they were in this country at first, and there was a lot of land.
Yeah.
Because I showed you a map where 130, 140 sections of land in one municipality given away to the CBR. So land was no scarcity.
No.
All this was all open land in them days. There was no residence around here.
No.
Because my brother moved to Waukau here in 1919, and I used to come and work for him. And in them days, there was a lot of land that wasn't open, that wasn't farmed yet. You know, they were opening up the land then, but these immigrants, they were coming in by the carload them days.
Uh-huh.
You know, I used to be in Waukau, and because that was a Ukrainian settlement, lots of times you'd see 10 people coming off the train and coming with bags on their back.
Oh, yeah.
They were coming to settle in this country, so. But in them days, in the 80s there, well, hell, there was nobody around this part of the country at all.
Yeah.
So there was that little bit of land along the river that we seen today. Well, what the hell harm would that have been to the country?
That's true.
They wouldn't have noticed it.
Yeah. When you have people like Wolfgang and me visiting you and you drive around, or when Howard was here, or when television comes and interviews you or so, and you tell them about the story and you meet other people, and you see that the young people today, I mean the Métis young people,
yeah,
are not interested much in the history or in the culture.
No.
And you old-timers maybe are the last, maybe the last two generations or so who really know about Métis culture and speak the language. Doesn't it make you very sad?
Well, it makes me feel that it's too bad that we weren't recognized. I think that, and now, as you say, that our young generation, well, you see, now our young generation, they figure that, you know, if there's nothing to do, well, you know, we'll just live on and with government help and stuff. But I would think that if the government would help us, and this is why what I stood up for sometimes, like now, they're talking about self-control and government control and land base or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But there's no way they can take away the land here from the people and give to the Métis people.
Oh.
I think that maybe up north, where the country is still vast and it's still farm and hunting mostly and things like that, there I think that the people of the north, if they're satisfied with that way of life, and if they want to, if the government wants to help them out by maybe donating land or whatever, whatever way they can help them, well, then I suppose it's all right. But for our way of life, I think that the Métis people should go for education.
Uh-huh.
I think that they should get the government to give them grants. Whoever cannot afford an education, if they would get help of some kind for to get educated, and you know, so that they can stand up amongst people.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not educated today, well, you know, you've got a very slim chance of getting to first base, if you want to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's my way of seeing it, in a way. You take, like, my children, I told you about my boy, that one that got crippled.
Yeah.
Well, if he wouldn't have it at his grade 12, he wouldn't be where he is. He wouldn't have had a chance of a job.
Right.
He wouldn't have had the first chance, and he'd have been on welfare, and he would be still on welfare.
Yeah.
But like now, well, he's worked 6 years, it'll be 7 years on the 1st of March, so now at least he's independent, he earns his own living, and he'd be much better off, because he was going in for engineering when he got hurt. So today he would be amongst any class of people, white people or anybody.
Mm-hmm.
He would hold his ground and he would make a living. And I think that there's not enough of us Métis people that try to hold our own with others.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think that we should try and get more education. But at all meetings that I go to, of course, though, I'll have to say that there is some that are going in for education, but they don't seem to get interested enough, the Métis people themselves. Like I sometimes tell them that we are to blame. We don't need to blame the next door neighbor or nothing if we've got nothing, because you see, I was that way when I was younger, though. As long as I had a way of life, and I was satisfied. But now I can see that we've got to try and do a little better if we want to get along in life. Again, I'm doing all the talking.
Yeah, but that's all right. That's why we came here, to listen to you.
Yeah.
I mean, you asked us quite a bit about Germany, and now we ask you again. So, so you get your question across now.
Anyway, well, it's a good thing, I think, to stand up to the government and with the government. And by doing that, I know that, you know, when the NDP were in power, I could help out the odd person. I had power, it seems. They recognized me, and you know, and when they do that, then you can help people a bit. So,
right.
And that's why that I don't change my colors or my way of voting. I figure if I can help people, and I know that the NDP are going to get back in, I'm sure they will. So we can try and help whoever we can. But I think it's too bad, really, that we didn't get together better. I still figure that our organization, like if Howard would have been the leader in place of Jim Sinclair, we would have contacted the government. We'd have put more pressure on the government, and I think we'd have done better.
Uh-huh.
That's my thinking.
Is Jim Sinclair still in office?
Well, they are in office to a point, but they are trying to split now. The non-status are the ones that are asking, and you know, they can see that there's something going on, but I am always a little bit leery about Jim Sinclair, because Jim Sinclair, I always have to give him credit, he's not a fool, and I don't know if I can say that I would think that he's that honest, because I would think that if he can pull for his side or pull for his group or whatever, I would be suspicious of him a bit. But so anyway, when they're starting to ask for a split. Well, being that they're asking for a split now, I always used to say that Jim Sinclair is using the Metis people to stay in power, and we don't know just how much he's getting out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I think that he's getting to the point where maybe he sees that if he breaks away, well, he'll be a leader again with another group, and I think maybe that's what he's trying now.
Right.
So here we'll be left in the open without even a leader, without an organization.
Yeah.
So I always kept telling you people better watch. We have to be leery about this, because something's going to happen. And I didn't have, well, even I don't know if I had enough knowledge, but I didn't have the time when I used to work. I used to work 10, 11 hours a day, so I didn't have no time to be running around every night to meet people and things. So, it seems to me that those that were working for the society, making their living with that, well, they could have looked into more.
Yeah.
Like in 85 there, hell, to me it was a disgrace the way the Metis people were treated. Like Canada, Parks Canada. You know, they had the control. They done as they pleased pretty well. So we could.
Come on, you want to pass or no?
I think he's afraid because of the traffic.
He's staying behind, is he?
Yeah, but he's just sort of almost bumper to bumper, and I don't like that. Somebody sitting in my back.
He was kind of blinding you, eh?
Yeah, well, I've got this mirror which you can which you can change.
The Metis Society of Saskatchewan nowadays, I mean, how powerful an organization is it really?
Well, you see, you can't tell really, because people don't stand up and show their colors that much. We'll have a meeting in St. Louis. They tell me that there's close or right around 200 members, paid up members.
Yes.
But we'll have a meeting and we'll have 12 to 15 people. Sometime maybe 20.
Yeah.
Maybe 20. That's a big meeting.
So, do we turn left here or go straight on?
No, straight on until we hit the river.
Okay.
So that is a bit disappointing, actually. It is.
Yeah. You take like myself. Well, I'm 83, and by golly, if it wasn't for me, well, you know, there's hardly anybody that's stuck to their colors as well as I did. They'll come if there's something to gain. If there's a class, you know, to learn, to take up grading or something, then you'll see maybe 10, 12, 15 of them coming on account of that upgrading. But as soon as the upgrading is finished, you don't even see them in a meeting.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you take like a batage. Well, my Lord, there was hardly anybody would take part in the meetings. So that's why I say that the people are to blame. They didn't stand up like they should have. And Jim, he always had a group, like in Saskatoon, he had a group of about two or three families there that stood their ground and stayed behind him. And there were Metis people, but they stood behind Jim. And then he had another group down south by Capel that way. There was the La Fontaines there, and they were Metis, but still, they were organized, and they got something out of it. You know, these La Fontaines, I'm not saying they stole money, but they would be organized, and they could get help through the government, and they got going with cattle and stuff, and they done good. And then these fellas in Saskatoon, this group of Componies and Trache and stuff like that, they had housing in the city of Saskatoon. They done good, you know, and they supported Jim because they were getting the green.
Sure.
But guys like me, well, I was in there on the start. That was before Jim got the power. We got quite a, in St. Louis, I managed to get 40 houses built, you know, and I know darn well that if I wasn't in the society and on that housing committee, but we done good for Duck Lake as well, you know, we done good for this neighborhood, but it was too bad because, you know, if we'd have got organized and tried, and if Jim would have accepted us Metis leaders, like my boy got elected as vice president, Butch. But, oh boy, I'm telling you, it wasn't too long they started to call meetings, and one time he spoke about decentralization, I guess.
No.
Or
self-determination.
Decentralizing from the top so that the locals would have more power.
Yeah.
But right now it's all local, it's all powerful at the top, eh? We have no power in the little locals. So he wanted to decentralize. But boy, I tell you, it wasn't long they prepared a group and they got him out of there. Because they were worried that if he stayed in there, he would be in opposition to Jim in no time. But that's not the way they should have took it. They should have worked and organized together against the government.
So what you're really suggesting is that there's quite a bit of self-interest involved rather than, you know, an urge to stand in for or step in for all the people. So it's local groups which benefit from the organization more so than all the people, right?
Just a minute, I didn't quite get
I said, that. I mean, what you're
so suggesting... So what, there are always some people ripping off.
Ripping off.
Oh, yeah, that's... that's the way it is.
Just,
you know,
a family here and an individual there.
Oh, but that's what I, that's what I mean. And
people
I
don't share.
And I wouldn't be scared to stand up and say that in front of Jim or anybody.
Yeah.
But that is, and I'm sure that Jim maybe wouldn't accept it, but
that's,
he knows
the same
damn
in Indian
he knows
politics. It's the same in Indian politics.
Yeah.
It's always a few professional Indians who rip off the rest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you see, that's where it is.
Yeah, happens everywhere.
But Jim will even stand up and say, well, not too long ago, Jim said, Midrick, he said, you're a good man. Well, I know. He knows damn well that I don't back down too easy, but...
You can take me home if you want.
Okay, yeah, we'll take you home. I was just wondering whether you wanted to stop for a drink, then we'll buy you a drink first.
Well, if you want to do that, but then we'll only have one and you can still drive.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we'll go in for a quickie, and then we take you home.
I'll pay one round.
Okay.
No, we pay.
It's on us.
Well... If you want
we started that tradition, we'll keep to it. You know how important it is to keep the traditions.
Yeah.
Otherwise, everything goes to pot.
So.
That's the end of the interview with Medrick McDougall at St. Louis, Saskatchewan, driving around between Fish Creek, Batoche, and other places of the Louis Riel Rebellion. And this was all recorded on September the 28th, 1987. Alan Chris John, is that right?
Yeah. Okay, but it does have some background information.
There was something in the student paper quite recently, too.
Yeah. I haven't even looked at it. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how accurate it is, because I assume that it'll be factually incorrect. So I don't want to read it.
Because it upsets you.
No, I'll read it and then I'll be trying to change it or suggest revisions to it, and I'm just not too interested in the can of worms. I assume that basically they're talking, what they say about it is correct, and it's a program designed for Native people.
Mm-hmm.
It's designed to be a one-year course, mm-hmm. hands-on.
It's postgraduate, right?
No.
So what is the background of the students who come here?
Generally speaking, they're mature students,
mm-hmm.
or students just out of high school with strong academic background.
Mm-hmm.
We look for experience in writing or media experience. Many of our students have already had jobs either in the mainstream media or in the local Native media,
mm-hmm.
and they come here to try to expand their horizons, maybe upgrade their skills,
mm-hmm.
or in the cases of some of the younger students, to find an area of aptitude within the field of journalism,
mm-hmm.
because we provide four basic training courses,
mm-hmm.
photography,
mm-hmm.
print, radio, and television production. Apart from that, you know, they have other background courses in terms of graphics and design,
mm-hmm.
Law and ethics, some basic writing courses,
mm-hmm.
Public speaking courses, and that sort of thing. The rest of the program is generally very much a hands-on, where they do everything from writing an original story to laying it out to pasting it up,
mm-hmm.
and producing newspapers. By the middle of the first term, our students are expected to produce their own weekly radio show, half hour a week.
Mm-hmm.
It's broadcast twice a week locally.
So it's a project learning.
Mm-hmm. It's a project learning.
Mm-hmm.
During the year, they'll be involved in at least producing two video documentaries, as well as undergoing studio work, like
mm-hmm.
in a studio news broadcast, that sort of thing.
Are there lots of radio stations on the reserves?
No, but it's increasing.
Mm-hmm.
I know even one of our former students is part of a group that has an application before the Canadian Radio and Television Commission this year to begin broadcasting out of Six Nations Reserve, just up the way,
mm-hmm.
Brantford.
Mm-hmm.
And they're already talking about having an FM station there and increasing the power. This is even before their AM approval
mm-hmm.
is through. But many of the reserves do have radio stations. I know
mm-hmm.
Ganawagi, they got
mm-hmm.
a radio station. There's other ones that are located in the west, and particularly from the northern communities.
Oh yeah.
There's a big requirement
yeah.
On radio broadcast, and you get into the north. There's a lot of native shows that are produced locally,
mm-hmm.
Sort of like a public. It's almost like public service radio,
mm-hmm.
where it's almost a necessity to life. And
yeah.
some of our students have been involved in that. In the past,
mm-hmm.
Some will be involved in the future as well when they go back and
mm-hmm.
perhaps expand, you know, at least the sense of production in the north. So there are the opportunities right within the community itself.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our students go back and they work on community level newspapers. Some make it into the mainstream media.
Mm-hmm.
And some choose not to continue with their career
mm-hmm.
in journalism, which
is understandable. Do you find that some of them, you said, some of them come straight from high school, and this may be their first year at college or university, that they go on into some other field?
At times we have had
some
students.
This is the first step, and it's a native program, and maybe
yeah.
it's easier to...
In some cases, yes, we've had several students that have gone through this program and then decided to... take a new course of study, and they've continued on right here at
mm-hmm.
Western
mm-hmm.
and gone on to their 4 years bachelor's degrees in,
mm-hmm.
In other areas.
But most of them
come in here particularly for the journalism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what I could imagine, I understand there's no native studies program at Western, is there?
No.
That if this is the only place where native students sort of have a foothold in this, that this could also be like a center where they meet, even if they then go on and study other courses.
Well, it's not been the case.
No.
It's not been the case. In fact, you're going to find that the number of native students here in the program, even though that we can accept up to 20 a year,
mm-hmm.
they're a minority of mm-hmm. native students that are on campus. All right.
I see.
We have, we are unusual in the sense that we have a lot of native students that have just gone through and participated in the mainstream academic sort of
mm-hmm.
production
mm-hmm.
line
mm-hmm.
that these universities have. You know, like in this area, my reserve alone, we've got. This university has produced a couple of medical doctors,
mm-hmm.
clinical psychologists,
mm-hmm.
A lot of teachers, librarians, nurses,
mm-hmm.
whatever. A lot of Native people go through,
mm-hmm.
you know, just the regular university
mm-hmm.
stream here
mm-hmm.
at Western. And really, you know, this program really hasn't been, you know, a focus.
Oh, yeah.
Focus for Native activities on
mm-hmm.
campus. At times, they have had some attempts to get active Native student groups
mm-hmm.
Started. And in those situations, they've looked to this program because we do have a solid block of Native
mm-hmm.
students
yeah.
To play a role in it. But there's nothing that's been that... enduring
mm-hmm.
over time, and I think in a sense our program is probably the worst choice
mm-hmm.
for trying to focus an enduring
because
type program
so short, huh?
Because it's a 1 year
yeah.
program
yeah, right.
and
mm-hmm.
what we need is some of our our four-year students to
get involved.
Yeah, mm-hmm. to get involved and to play mm-hmm. that type of lead role.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that as coming?
It's a possibility. I know that the university is at least aware to the extent that they do have a subcommittee
mm-hmm.
Of the Senate organized mm-hmm. to look at, you know, how can we better address the Native students' issues or their concerns on campus. But, you know, that process has been going on for a number of years, and that takes no one anywhere.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think I know what you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, it's a sort of a place where some people can go and they can let off steam and say, geez, we're really mm-hmm. supportive, and really nothing occurs mm-hmm. of any right. substance.
I just learned that this periodical that I got some sample copies of, I think 2 years ago, Ontario Indian,
yes.
is gone again. Is that right? how did that happen, you know?
Gee, you came to the right place.
Oh,
I yeah.
didn't know that.
The Ontario Indian magazine was
I saw
was
two
actually,
sample copies of it.
Yeah.
They sent it to me.
It was going on for a couple of years. Actually, uh-huh. the second director that was the second director of this program
mm-hmm.
Used to be the editor of Ontario Indian Magazine. And actually, it sort of went into remission. And it sort of started dying when he left to come to the Native journalism program here.
Mm-hmm. What did
and it, and it converted. It converted over time to a thing called Sweetgrass Magazine. And I think they were able to produce one or two issues before they finally went under. Originally, the Ontario Indian Magazine was a magazine it was a sort of a house organ, started off as a house organ for the Union of Ontario Indians, which is an Indian political group out of Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
Combination of about 40 Indian bands in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And it started off as a house organ, but then it started becoming a legitimate
mm-hmm.
magazine in its
mm-hmm.
own right. And over time, the Indian political group was supplying a good portion of the support monies
mm-hmm.
to continue with the Ontario Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the government agencies had programs that could provide a sort of seed money arrangement
mm-hmm.
to help subsidize. About the time that it just so happens that times occur when all of these monies seem to run out about the same time. And unfortunately, it was at a time as well when it was becoming increasingly difficult for the Union of Ontario Indians to financially
mm-hmm.
provide support as well, because of the costs of their political battles, particularly relating to the Constitution. It
yeah.
became
mm-hmm.
very difficult to
mm-hmm.
to justify the kind of expenditures that were required. So
did they spend a lot of money on lawsuits, I guess?
No.
No?
No. Production costs.
Right.
Because anytime...
No, I mean the union.
Oh, yeah, on
yeah.
lawsuits. But a lot of it is just travel and maintaining lobbying efforts,
okay.
you know,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. I know at one time the subsidy from the political group alone was in excess of like $200,000 a year, right? And plus subsidies like from the Secretary of State and the appropriate provincial ministries.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite an extensive...
mm-hmm.
undertaking an operation, and you can read in it that, you know, the quality of the
exactly.
magazine.
I was thinking when I saw that, I thought, I wonder who puts this out, and then I saw that, because it seemed so glossy, and maybe I'm Eurocentric when I think if something that is Native American is so glossy and so costly, I always think that the finances maybe are coming from a third party that may not really be following the native interests. So I was wondering how this worked, because it seemed to be produced, I mean, on this nice
yeah.
paper and many colors and all that.
Well, it was part government, part the Indian political groups and part independent financing, mm-hmm. all right? But because of the limited, yeah, mm-hmm. the limited audience, though,
yeah.
You know, there are, your audience, your the available advertisements are one thing, but you can only advertise so much,
mm-hmm.
all right, because of, you know, your circulation.
Yeah.
And there is a certain limited interest. Mm-hmm. And Ontario Indian was a very fine magazine,
yeah.
but it would be difficult to find that on mm-hmm. any newsstand or any demand for it. And increasingly it became more and more important for it to become self-supporting, and it just wasn't able to reach an adequate level to keep going. And it's unfortunate because some good stuff in there.
I understand that. I think Akrasasna Notes also put out a glossy, I think, 4 issues a year or so, magazine for art.
It was a tabloid sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. But that didn't survive.
That's continuing.
Is it continuing?
Oh, yeah.
That seems to be very costly in production, too, and I wonder how many people are able to find it.
No, it isn't very costly.
No?
Actually, I used to work for there.
Uh-huh.
I helped reorganize some of the business aspects of it back in
Akrasasna News?
Yeah, Akrasasna Notes.
Right, Notes, that's what I mean.
Yeah, that's continuing.
That's the best Indian newspaper around the world, I think.
Yeah, actually, that was the production of that isn't that involved or that costly. All right.
You mean the notes or the
notes.
Magazine? Oh yeah, the notes obviously not.
Obviously not compared to the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, the fact that most of the work, at least when I was involved, I understand now it's a bit more self-supporting, and that
mm-hmm.
they actually pay the people to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
When I worked on it, it was generally volunteer work, that's what allowed it to reach.
Exactly.
That level of growth, that level of circulation, that I don't think it's ever going to disappear. You know,
mm-hmm.
just by the level of growth and support that it, mm-hmm. that it had in its early mm-hmm. days, it's going to continue.
There are many universities that subscribe to all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's,
and individuals, of course.
Most university libraries, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
I think Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor,
mm-hmm.
you know, provides, does the cataloging and the
mm-hmm.
microfilming
exactly.
of Akrasasna Notes.
And even the America houses abroad, they tend to have it, although some of the news in there is not exactly what they love to read.
What they want to hear, but...
No, but,
yeah.
I mean, there's such a demand for it,
yeah.
so they do have it, because otherwise customers will be disappointed and go home. And they wouldn't like that.
Well, it's strange you came in here and you asked me about my two main, areas of background.
Uh-huh.
Good, being
though.
A working journalist, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that's sort of the background that brought me here to this program.
How long were you involved with the notes?
Well, I was involved there off and on for several years.
What life had you used?
Oh, boy. Well, I met my wife there,
uh-huh.
so, and I met her in, 77,
mm-hmm.
oh, like about 75 through 78,
mm-hmm.
those kind of years.
You know Maurice Kenny?
No.
So, Paul, he publishes and partly in the notes, he's Mohawk, but I think he lives in New York City.
Yeah, I don't know. It was, in those days, the operation was quite a bit different than
mm-hmm.
perhaps a lot of people had the perception of,
I wrote to Notes at that time. I started teaching about Native Americans.
Well, I probably...
In 77, and I should dig up some of the old stuff, you know. Once I sent some nasty letters because I'd ordered something and it never came. Well, you know how things like that are. So.
Yeah.
And some of my students, we made a collective order. I don't even recall what it was.
Yeah.
I'd never been together with Native Americans before, so I think I took a very European or German stand. Things must just work.
Well, actually, you know, that was the proper stand to take at that time. Most of the, most of the people at that time, there was a maybe, at the most, at any one time, 10 of us.
Yeah, that's the feeling I had, and it was a different person each time that
to write.
I kept getting invoices for things I paid.
Yeah.
So I don't know what.
So yeah, it was a, but it was a purely a business, a business type of thing. You know, at that time we did have some Europeans that came over.
You know, Klaus Bieger?
Who?
Klaus?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, he's a good friend.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I've met him and talked to him a couple of times. He was over about two or three times when I was there.
I think at least honorarily or so on the editorial board was listed there. He does a good. I think he does a lot of good work.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Klaus.
Any others?
Gee, I don't recall their names because we had people. It just seemed like they'd come in.
Oh yes.
Every week we'd have another group of people.
That's
over.
One of the reasons I never went there because I knew that it was sort of a halfway house for German Indian freaks coming to the U.S. They came to New York, you know, John F. Kennedy, and then they hitchhiked up to Akrasasma. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was an interesting time. I know perhaps. I think they left with a greater appreciation of the work we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they were kind of surprised at the sort of
conditions
we worked under, but the sort of priorities that it forced on us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were actually working on a newspaper. The living part of it to us was secondary because, you know, like we did have our own gardens, we did do our own layout, our own typesetting, we did our own writing, we did everything. And the living part of it was the easy part.
Mm-hmm.
And we always said to ourselves up there, you know, if all we had to do up here was live, and we didn't have to worry about this stupid newspaper, life would be terrific. And I know a lot of people came up, you know, and they were saying...
For the living part.
For the living part. Mm-hmm. They'd come up to say, well, how are you guys living? And we're living, you know, like if you're coming up here to learn Indian ways, you're at the wrong place right now because we're busy putting out a newspaper.
I think I know what you're talking about. When I was at UC Davis, I talked at DK University, which is an Indian Chicano college, and a lot of my friends were there. They had a very hard time surviving, which the fact that Dennis Banks was the chancellor of the college at that time didn't help. The college, I mean, so they had one investigation after the other,
which was
really directed at Dennis, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, they cleared all that, and they seem to be doing fine. I just saw them 4 weeks ago. But some of my students from Germany who had founded their AIM support group over there, and so they came, and this was just before the Sundance, and one of them, he went over there to put up some of the structure around and help. It's really hot in California.
Yeah.
It gets very hot. So he did that for one day, and that was the end of the AIM support group. He's a nice guy, you know, but he probably thought that as soon as he met some Native Americans, he would just sit and drink the wisdom dropping off the lips or mouths, and all he had to do was work. You know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, the reality of it is, I won't say it's less than the expectations, but it's certainly different sometimes.
It shows that people are people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know, I enjoyed the experience I had there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like we run into similar things from this program too, some of the Native people. We do have a current issues component of... of our program, because we do have to give everyone a solid journalistic background in Native issues so that they can do their jobs as journalists. But I know that some of them were hoping for a large cultural component as part of this program, but here, you know, we teach journalism and the techniques of journalism and the so, in some cases, even our students may be surprised, you know. But there are things that they have to learn. We hope that they can find out how to be Indians when they get home, because the diversity here is
You don't great. Want them to turn them into professional Indians.
No.
But into Indian professionals, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, we have people that attend this program that come from the Arctic Circle, you know.
Yeah, I just met this one guy who's Inuit.
Yeah, we go from BC to mm-hmm. Northwest Territories to the Maritimes, and so our group is very, very culturally diverse, and mm-hmm. To try to even attempt to explain or delve into the diversities mm-hmm. that we have is mm-hmm. just, it's an impossible task. Yeah. It's impossible. Yeah. It's kind of like going to Europe and say, I want to learn English, Welsh, German, French, and Spanish culture.
That's what I always tell people, yeah. that the Indian cultures are as diverse as Turkish and Icelandic, which is, or more, you know. Yeah. And a lot of people are not aware of it, because and the stereotype one is just like the other. It's a pan-Indian mesh in our heads, I mean.
Yeah. I've got to watch this, because it's almost...
I'm running out of tape, that's the bad thing. I bought one new one, and I talked to somebody this morning, and that was a whole tape, so... which is too bad. I didn't know you'd been involved with Akwesasne and with Ontario Indian.
I've been involved with both. I've been in...
I've been a sidelight
to history all the way through, so I've seen most of the things,
mm-hmm.
Most of the events, from the old BIA takeover,
mm-hmm.
and,
we were there.
All the way through the Restigouche Salmon Wars, you know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've generally been there, mm-hmm. or involved, at least to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Through the constitutional struggles. I used mm-hmm. to be the executive director of the National Political Organization, the old National Indian Brotherhood.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
During the time that we were doing and organizing the lobbies in Great Britain against
mm-hmm.
the British.